Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Harry Kramer. Harry's an executive partner with Madison Dearborn. He is the former CEO of Baxter International. He's a professor of leadership at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Business, where he has been awarded as Professor of the Year, among many other accolades. He is the author of four values-based leadership books, including his most recent book, which was just released, Your Values-Based Legacy. He is a sought-after business resource, champion of the One Acre Fund, which promotes and supports small farmers across the African continent, and he is one of the most humble leaders I have had the pleasure of meeting. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you, as he is going to dive in with tons of energy, tons of insight, and lots of application across all of our conversations. He's going to share things like the two things leaders need to know to be successful. He's going to talk us through his relate, influence, lead framework and why that order is so important. He will share his four leadership principles that are present throughout his writing and his leadership. And he is going to talk about why he believes providing feedback is a moral requirement. It's a great conversation that I can't wait to dive into. Before we do, really quick, let's thank our sponsors. First, we have Humantel. For everyone listening who's wanted to develop the skill set of understanding what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing shifts in emotions through facial expressions and nonverbal communication, Humantel.com is the website you need to go to. Read their research, learn the science behind their techniques, and then take the self-paced online training of your choice. When you do, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class available online training on the subject. I highly recommend it. I've done it myself. It's all there at Humantel.com. For the professional interviewers listening, please head over to CertifiedInterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn more about what the membership requirements are at the individual and organizational level, and then the educational opportunities, the individual resources, the in-person and online events, how you can contribute to the organization, and so much more. While you're there, you can also learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify to sit for the exam? How to study and prepare for the exam? Once you pass the exam, what does it take to maintain your certification? And what can the certification mean for you and your career moving forward? All of that and more over at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out Inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the training programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, their negotiators, their business development professionals, and even their HR teams to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences across all of their high-value conversations. All that and more at Inquasive.com. We appreciate you being here this week. Thank you for coming back week after week to continue to learn from all of our amazing guests. And now, without further ado, I introduce to you Harry Kramer. Hey, Harry, it is so great to see you again. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. How are you today?
Great to be with you. I'm doing very well, my friend. If five children and one grandson are good, I'm good. So all good.
Amen to all of that. So not too long ago, maybe a month or so ago, you and I had the opportunity to share the stage, so to speak, at an event, and I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation. I took a bunch of notes, and I'm really excited to ask a few questions I thought of then, but to even go well beyond that with the time we have today. So when I was watching you speak that day, I was not only captivated by the value, like 100% educational the whole time, but your energy throughout and the way you kind of worked in humorous examples and very humble in how you went through the session. So one of the notes I took that I had to ask you based on a comment you made during your session was, I'd be grateful if you could explain to us, how did you manage to become a CEO of a multi-billion dollar company before you turned 185 years old?
Okay. So Mike, you know, you take good notes. You're on top of things. So, no, and I think your audience will appreciate this as well. When I first became the CFO, it was Baxter International, a global healthcare company. And by the way, my business card never read Chief Financial Officer. It read CFO, Cash Flow Officer. As a business guy, you know, it's all about cash flow. And I just become the cash flow officer. And the chairman of the company, a super phenomenal guy in his 80s, he's one of the founders, Mr. Graham, William Graham, he took me to lunch and he said, Harry, a lot of people, I think including your audience, Mike, before they get promoted to their next job, they think they need to know everything about that next job or they're not really qualified. So he said, Harry, in your case, if you're one of a bunch of different people who could be the potential next CEO, but there's a big list of people. But Harry, if you need to know everything about being the CEO before you, how long would it take you? I said, Mr. Graham, I said, I only know about half of this CFO job. I don't know. He said, well, I do know. I've been doing this for 40 years. I'm watching you. In your case, if you needed to know everything about being the CEO before you became a CEO, you'd be about 185 years old. But he said, I got great news for you. And the news, I think, is true for every swingable in your audience here, Mike, because he basically said, any job you're ever in, this includes you, Mike, includes anybody. He said, any job you're in the rest of your life, Harry, there's only two things you ever have to know. Oh, Mr. Graham, what's that? The first thing you have to know, what are your God-given abilities? What are you really good at? Whether it's people, analytics, what are you really, really good at? That's the first thing you have to know. He said, the only other thing you have to know is who knows what you don't know. I said, Mr. Graham, this is going to work out perfect. I got about 50 people who know what I don't know. I keep them very close. And so this whole idea of, oh, I'm really worried. No, if I can get the people who can help me, things are going to work out great. Things are going to work out great. And it's interesting, Mike, a lot of people sort of think, oh, as you move up in an organization, it gets harder and harder. Well, Mike, you're a pretty bright guy. Think about it. If I'm a first level manager for the first time with 8 analysts, and I got the right 8 people, not 5, I got 8 out of 8. I got the right people. I'm developing them and helping them, nurturing them. Well, when you're a CEO, you've got 8 people. The difference is they're all executive vice presidents who should be prepared to run their own company. So if you've got the right people, and if you delegate, and if you develop people, you know, it should be pretty good. But you got to know what you know, and you better know who knows what you don't know.
I love that. And when I heard you say part of that before, so there are people who think I'm cheating with my first question. I did. But when I heard you say that, when we were together in New York, I started nodding my head and thinking about how many leaders I've met throughout the years, and I'm sure you have as well, and listeners have too, who they almost safeguard what they don't know because they're afraid. Like if people know that I don't know this, or if they let on that I don't know, I'll be weak or I won't be smart or I won't be capable. So whether it's that BS fake it till you make it, or they just force control over everything. And I feel like I could list any number of successful leaders who I've seen walk into a room and been like, here's the problem. I don't know the answer. This isn't my background. I need somebody who's smarter than me. But to have the humility and the confidence to do that, I feel like is exceedingly rare in today's business world.
No, Mike, you're absolutely right. And we'll talk about things. Mike, I keep things very simple and I boil them into 4 things that you well know. Self-reflection, balanced perspective, true self-confidence, and genuine humility. And you raise a great point because when people say, well, what's this true self-confidence thing? What's the true? And I'll say, well, a lot of people can act very self-confident. I've worked with them, Mike, but do you have true self-confidence? And I'll say, well, if you have true self-confidence, 2 things. One, are you willing to admit when you don't know? Are you willing to admit when you are wrong? Are you willing to admit when you don't know when you're wrong? And often, Mike, it'd be a little bit like someone says, well, but what's Mike going to think if I tell him I don't know? Well, if you think about leadership, influence, relate, most people, Mike, don't relate well with people who know everything. Most people don't relate well with people that never make a mistake. And if I say, Mike, I don't know, but I'm looking at my watch, Mike, how fast do you need an answer? Because I know somebody who knows. I think you may say, you know what? I can relate to Harry. I don't know everything. If you can relate, I can influence, I can lead. It's the opposite, Mike, of what most people fear. But what you'll love, Mike, I do a lot of coaching, right? And I have this one CEO who said, you know, I've read all your stuff on self-reflection. I get it. Balance, I've read it. I get it. But this true self-confidence, I got a real problem. I said, Joe, what's that? He says, you know what? I got 800 people working for me. I do not want them to know what I don't know. I hold my cards close. I'm not going to divulge what I don't know. What do you think about that? I said, you know, Joe, they already know what you don't know. They're wondering whether you know what we don't know, or is this whole ship going down, right? And as you know, Mike, it gets very tiring, exhausting to have to feel like you know everything. And by the way, it doesn't help you out because it helps you relate to people less, because nobody can relate to these people.
I couldn't agree more. I'm trying to figure out which place to go first with everything that you just said. But the part that I love the most, I think, is when you said they already know what you don't know. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. It's, I think back to my investigations career. By the time an investigation got to me, everybody else already knew about it. Like, so for me to walk in and be like, okay, we have to control who knows what and who's talking to who. No, it's gone. The lid is blown off of this whole thing. So the sooner you can just accept the fact that everybody knows what you don't, you can figure out the best path to go ahead and put the pieces together and get the truth. And I couldn't agree more possibly with the sign of true self-confidence being who can admit when they're wrong and who can admit what they don't know. Absolutely. We can all sniff out the false bravado. We can all sniff out when people are acting a certain way because they're afraid. They don't want you to see through them. And there might be people listening to this that are like, Mike, I remember you X amount of years ago and you might have done the same thing. Yeah, you're right. I might have. Thankfully, I had people that helped me along the way and see the error of my ways and change and grow. Right. Yeah. I think it's like the old, I'm probably getting this wrong, but the old Sun Tzu quote, like when you're strong, make them think you're weak. I'm probably getting that twisted a little bit.
That's close. That's close. Yeah.
We don't have to go that far, but just that willingness to say, you know, okay, tell me, educate me. I don't need to know everything. I just need to be the guy, to your point, give me a minute. I can make a phone call. I need to be the guy who can get the answers. That's the most important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Knowing who knows, knowing and being open enough that you're helping people so they help you. And it works. It's all, in fact, I usually think of this stuff like is common sense. And then I have to always quote the great line, you know, from Mark Twain, everything is common sense. The problem, common sense is not common, right? So welcome to the world we're in. Absolutely. Absolutely.
An unfortunate truth all these years later. And people might not realize it, but what you just gave us in that last answer, if I heard you correctly, were your four core principles of leadership, right? Your four principles of value-based leadership.
Yeah.
And I love it when a plan comes together. I'll pretend like this was the plan, but really it was just a fortuitous set of circumstances. But I believe your next book comes out tomorrow, the day after we're recording this. So can you please walk us through how your next book ties, there it is, your values-based legacy. How does your next book factor into your four core principles of value-based leadership?
Sure. So great, Mike. So I'll back up for you. So when I stepped down as the CEO of Baxter, and it turned out the fellow who had been my finance professor at Kellogg had become the dean, and I know him very, very well. And when I was leaving Baxter, he said, I need you to teach. And I said, you don't mean like have a syllabus, great papers. That's not happening. I run companies. And he said, I think you said you would do whatever I asked you to do. So here I was. And he thought I was going to do finance. And I said, you know what? Some of these guys have got PhDs, you know, I got an MBA. So what do you want to do? I said, I would love to focus on leadership, value, and ethics. What does it really mean to be a leader? How do you be a leader? How do you develop people? And he said, that's fine. You start in 2 weeks. And so what I first did in the beginning, Mike, my first class was all about, no kidding around, what does it take to be a value-based leader? Which is really all about those four principles, right? And then I thought, okay, I'm kind of done. And they said, well, no, that's how you're a value-based leader, but how do you build a value-based organization? And that became the second book, Becoming the Best. And I said, all right, well, now I'm done. But interestingly enough, I got rolling, Mike. And right before COVID, people said, all right, that's how you're a value-based leader. That's how you develop a value-based organization. How do you develop a value-based life? All right. And as you well know, Mike, it isn't work-life balance. It's life balance. How do you balance your career, your family, your faith, your health, have a little bit of fun, realizing we're on this earth for a blink of an eye? How do we make a difference while we're passing through? And that was your 168, because Mike, every one of us has 168 hours in a week, 24/7. And then right before I started teaching my last class last year, they said, all right, value-based leader, value-based organization, value-based life. How do you develop a value-based legacy? We're all blessed. We're all very fortunate. All your listeners are. What difference do we want to make in the world? And it's not just success, it's significance. You know, what do you do? And where did it come from? How did you first develop this? Did it come from your grandfather, your parents? You know, were you in the first grade where they give you a little milk bottle you're supposed to fill up with nickels and dimes to send to some disadvantaged people? What did you do during? And legacy sometimes, as you know, Mike, it sort of gets caught up in, oh, it's about the money. It's about, well, no, it's It could be time. It could be talent. It could be a little treasure. But what example do you set? And you don't have to do this by yourself. How do you get a team of people? And someone will say, oh, there's all these major issues. Well, there may be all these major issues, but what can you do? What can you do? And I often will tease Michael in class. Very often we'll talk about all the issues in the world, global poverty, digital divide, the environment. Oh, who's going to deal with all these issues? And I always tease Mike, there's this famous group of people that I'm sure you've heard of that are going to solve all these problems. It's usually called those guys. There's some magical group of men and women. It's a gender-neutral term. And I always remind people, Mike, we are those guys. If we're not the men or women who's going to do something about it, who the heck is? Who the heck is? Look in the mirror, okay, and realize, you know what? If you could start with small, okay? You can just spend one night a week in a soup kitchen. You can get two, three or four guys together and do something for Habitat for Humanity, all right? What difference can you make in the short time? And don't you feel an obligation if you're blessed to be able to make a difference? And that really is what the book comes out tomorrow, Chief. That's what's the fourth book is.
Fantastic. And this, by the time this episode comes out, the book will already be out. Within the last week or so. So if you're listening to this conversation, you're like, this is great. You just named the title of all four of your books so people can go spend their time on Amazon and find all of them, but they won't have to because we'll put the links in the show notes. So they'll be able to get them directly there.
Thank you.
So what I would love to do is kind of step back and say, with the legacy piece in mind, and I don't want to skip over one kind of minor, but not so minor detail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got talked into being a professor on 2 weeks' notice, but at the Kellogg School, you have won Professor of the Year among other accolades. So you didn't just jump into it. I'd say you figured it out and you've built quite the reputation and network with the students and faculty there as well. So congratulations on all you've done.
Well, thank you.
As we take a look at the legacy piece of it, let's tie that back to leadership just for a moment, and then we'll jump outside of work because there's no reason for us not to. What are ways that newer emerging leaders can start to employ your values early in order to begin to lay the foundation of their eventual legacy?
Yeah. So, Michael, phenomenal question. Okay. And I didn't know what you were going to ask, but this is great. Here's the way I think about this. And this all relates, Mike, you go as deep as you want to on I call it this first principle. And the whole idea, Michael, you, me, all of your listeners, we've all got a lot to do. We got more to do than time to do it. And the usual reaction is, we'll just go faster and faster. This is where the multitasking kicks in, right? And then, of course, we've got all these things, right? Blackberries, blueberries, you know, iPads, all these things. And the great focus in my mind is that most of us say, well, I'll just multitask. And I think the very first thing that a real leader needs to do, Mike, very honestly, is take the time to self-reflect, which basically means you take a short amount of time, Mike, you turn off the noise, you turn off the devices, you get off by yourself, and you ask yourself a series of questions. And I can send them to you, Mike. They're on the website. But they're questions like the following. What are my values? What is my purpose? No kidding around, what really matters? This is not an advertising campaign. This isn't a job interview. You're by yourself, Mike, maybe significant enough. What matters and why? What kind of a leader do you want to be? What kind of example do you want to set for people around you? And I basically tell people, I don't think I can do that when I'm doing 10 other things at the same time. But taking a little bit of time to think about this, Mike, helps me separate out activity and productivity. It helps me separate out the difference between important and urgent, and it helps me get from the roots to the trees to the forest. It helps me put this all to what's my purpose? What am I on this earth for? How does this all fit together? And it's sort of almost slowing down to move faster, Mike, figuring out what matters and why. And I often will tease people, Mike, that one of the crazy things is any one of your listeners, by the way, can determine, Mike, whether somebody is self-reflective by talking to them for about 10 minutes. Because people that are not self-reflective are constantly surprised, and you're surprised, they're surprised. There's a lot of surprised people walking around, okay? But if you're self-reflective, I'm not so sure why you should be surprised, right? I'll see a student, Mike, and they'll say, Harry, I'm just really surprised. Well, Phil, why are you surprised? Well, I have two young boys now, and I have no relationship with my two sons. I'm just really surprised. Phil, do you spend time with your two sons? No, I don't spend any time with them at all. Oh, but you're surprised. I'm surprised you're surprised, okay? Because if you're self-reflective, Mike, you don't know when it's going to happen, but it will happen. Because life doesn't go like this. You will, It goes up and it goes down, right? So why don't you think through when, not if, when things go down, what are we going to do? And that self-reflection piece, some people say to me, Harry, why do you call that the first most important? Simple thought, Mike, three parts. If I'm not self-reflective, is it possible for me to know myself? I don't think so. Part two, if I don't know myself, can I lead myself? I don't think so. The third part, Mike, if I can't lead myself, how could I possibly lead other people, right? So this whole idea of if I'm going to be a value-based leader, it starts with me, and I better make sure I can do that. And that example that I set can significantly impact others as well.
Well, I remember being a kid and not necessarily being the most focused or the most successful or the most disciplined or the most trouble-free young man. And time after time having conversations with my parents and swearing to them that, you know, I get it this time, I'm going to learn, it's going to be different. And honestly, at the time I said it, I probably meant it. Like I wasn't going out of my way to have these issues. But I remember my dad telling me on multiple occasions, I can't help you if you won't help yourself.
Bingo. Bingo, Mike. Bingo, bingo, bingo. It starts with you. And then right after it starts with you, Mike, you got to find a couple of people you can bounce this off of because, you know, we can all fool ourselves, right? And I'm very blessed with my spouse now of 44 years. She'll often say to me, hey, Harry, left to your own devices, you could convince yourself of anything. Do you want to know what I think? Now, at least in my case, Mike, the answer to that better be yes, or I'm going to be in a heck of a lot of hot water. Even if I don't think it's yes, the answer is yes. Julie, I want to know what you think. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've been waiting to ask. Please tell me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In the how to sustain a marriage portion of this conversation, the answer to that question is always yes. I'm going to continue to agree with you. Maybe I'll try to find a way not to agree with you later. But we can't truly understand how to connect with other people until we understand ourselves. What's important to us? What sets us off? How and why do we react to certain triggers? Where are our soft spots? You know, where are we likely to get drawn in? Where are we likely to get put off? That creates the contextual awareness that helps us do a much better job delegating, leading, connecting, influencing, all of these other things that we've talked about. So I'm completely on board with self-reflection being the first principle. So how does self-reflection in turn set us up to do a better job with the next three?
Boy, oh boy, Mike, you're on top of this. You could teach my class. If I'm self-reflective, if I'm self-aware, if I've slowed down enough to figure out what's going on, now I can handle the second one, Michael, which I literally call developing a balanced perspective. And what I mean by that, Mike, you know what? We could talk about any topic today. We could talk about Ukraine. We could talk about, you know, the Middle East. We could talk about the presidential election tomorrow. You name it. And often, Michael, people have very, very strong opinions. The problem I find often is people with very strong opinions, Michael, they have their opinion, but they have virtually no understanding of thoughts other than their own. And I actually believe, Michael, part is a benefit of self-reflection, slowing down and speed up. You can start to say to yourself, balanced perspective. What does it mean? You take the time to understand multiple perspectives. Or I like to use a line supposedly attributed to St. Francis. I say this every day. I seek to understand before I'm understood. I seek to understand. If I'm having a discussion with you, Michael, and on a particular issue, you want to go north and I think we ought to go south, I try not to say, Michael, I don't understand where you're coming from. Because I actually decided that's actually ignorant. If I take the time, I can understand. Then I'll decide, do I agree or disagree? Okay. And I don't know if you thought about this, Michael, but this is what happens when you teach and you get into this philosophical mode. Think about the number of times this happened at a board meeting the other day. A guy named Tony said, well, by the way, when people say, oh, I don't understand. I don't understand where you're coming from. Usually, Michael, they don't want to understand. They're just telling you they disagree. So I was at a board meeting the other day and a guy named Tony said, well, Harry, I don't understand. I said, Tony, would you like to understand? Because if you'd like to understand, pal, I'm happy to explain it to you. And then, by the way, feel free to agree or disagree. And Michael, the reason the stuff that you're doing is so important, as you well know, we have become so polarized as a society now. And part of it, you probably know better than I, you know, it's social media, it's echo chambers. Now, as you well know, you can be wherever you want to be. But if you're on the far right, and as a result of echo chambers, everything you hear is exactly consistent with what you want to hear. And I'm on the left and everything I hear. Well, now when we're having a discussion, Michael, How do you possibly believe that? I've got all the information, right? And that that need to understand multiple perspectives, or another one of my grandfather's quotes, and I got a lot of them because he lived with us when I was growing up sometime. He used to say to me when I was small, he said, Harry, life is much simpler when you only understand your side of the story. There are multiple sides of the story, okay? And this ability to say, well, why does Michael believe that? I value the guy. He's a good guy. Why does he believe that? And again, I may agree or disagree, but we've moved Michael from, hey, I value you, buddy, and you have a different view, but I like you too. I disagree. I hate you. I have to stop you. Pretty bad place to be, Michael. We better get our act together. And it's the self-reflection that helps realize I may have one perspective, but there's a lot. That's why, Michael, when I'm doing talks or whatever, I always say, I have very few answers. I have many opinions. I don't do Q&A, question and answer. I do a lot of Q&O, question and opinion, okay? And I'm really anxious to hear someone. And by the way, if your opinion, you'll love this, Michael. If your opinion makes more sense to me, you want to go north, I want to go south. I'm listening. I'm pretty sure it's south. I'm listening to you. As soon as I realize, Michael's saying makes more sense. Hey, Michael, forget about South. Why? I have absolutely no need to be right. I'm fanatically focused on trying to do the right thing. Being right has nothing to do with this. And again, you got to make sure you park your ego at the door, because some people, it's ego. It's ego. I got to be right. Well, forget it. You're not going to always be right.
No, and if you're me, it's not you're not always going to be right. You frequently may actually be wrong. I think that without getting too much into the socio-political piece of all of it, unfortunately, whether you want to blame it on any specific thing, social media, on and on and on, we've devolved, is devolved the word? We've devolved to a point where we're actually more incentivized to stay within our echo chamber than to look outside of it. So you're no longer curious. You're no longer looking to find middle ground. You're no longer solution focused. You're a friggin' traitor. And we don't want to be that, not to our core networks, not to our core beliefs, maybe not even to something that I've said out loud before. And I really thought was right the day that I said it, but a lot of days have passed since then. So now I might have an evolved perspective. So that it's a much bigger problem to solve, but that incentivization of where we should be and what we should be doing is such a problem. And unfortunately, in so many ways, the riddle of how our minds work has been solved. Yeah. So people know how to play on that to achieve.
Well, and Michael, you raised such a great point. And, without getting into the politics of who did what to who, the reality of it is, it used to be okay to have an opinion. And then I listened to you, and I realized, no, that makes more sense. Well, now if you move, change your opinion, you're a flipper. You're a, what's the word? You're just you're a flip. Well, wait a minute. Why would I keep the same view if I now have more information? In fact, I somebody gave me the book, not one of mine, but I thought it was interesting. You may be aware of it, Michael, but I thought it was great. This Adam Grant fellow, who is a professor at Wharton, he wrote a book somebody gave me called Think Again. And a concept I thought was very cool. I have my own views. I know what I think. But wait a minute. Michael's given me some thoughts. I'm going to think again. And by the way, I may change my mind completely. Why wouldn't I? Why would I get trapped in the way I used to think about things? But you're right. We've ended up in this bizarre world now where, hey, this is my team and this is the enemy. Wait a minute. No, we're all on this earth. Let's find some common ground, right? Common ground. The answer to most things I find to be somewhere in the middle. But there's no middle if you just have your view. No, it's a serious, serious problem, Gee. Serious problem.
For sure.
By the way, we got one thing, Michael. It's just good we can help one another. I never mention a problem without a potential solution, because you and I are optimistic guys. Glass isn't half full, glass is overflowing. All right, so what do we do? Well, here's what I tell the students as an opinion. What do? You either complain about it or you say the following. Okay, if I'm going to watch Fox, I better watch a little CNN. If I'm going to read the New York Times, I better read a little bit of the New York Times, maybe the Financial Times, maybe the Economist, a bunch of different podcasts, for sure, Michael's podcast, all right? And then you listen to all of this. You listen to all of this, Michael, and you realize, wow, there's a, okay, now in an educated way, what do I think? That's one benefit. And the other one is, even if I disagree, at least I know why Michael believes that. As opposed to, how could he possibly believe that? No, he's not an idiot. There must be some reasons he or she believes that. And then you learn more, because we're trying to learn, right? It's not about ego. So, yeah, it's a major opportunity. And that's the way we got to do it. We got to make sure we have visibility so we can understand why people believe what they believe.
Agreed entirely. And it's one of the things that I like to think is true, is that when we're engaging in a conversation, the moment we feel uncomfortable is the most important time to start to truly listen.
Absolutely.
Usually when we start to feel uncomfortable, that's when we batten down the hatches. That's when we go to our defenses. You're wrong. I'm right. That can't be true. But if I just say to myself, now I should probably listen because there's a chance that there's something I missed. There's something I don't know. There's something I don't understand. And in a weird way, that's something that I was taught as an investigator. Because when you sit down and talk to people who made regrettable decisions, I would bet everything I've got that 90% or more of the people I ever interviewed would have made a different choice under a different set of circumstances.
Wow.
That doesn't absolve them of accountability or responsibility. No. They got to, like my uncle used to say, you do the crime, you do the time. Like, I'm not taking any of that away. But to understand the universality of the human experience, which you don't have to dig that deep to get to. You don't have to go that far to think of, well, a reasonably intelligent and rational human being can make that decision in this set of circumstances. So to your point about trying to understand, why does somebody think that way? Why did they act that way? What put them in the situation? It doesn't make us weak. It doesn't even necessarily make us right or wrong. It just allows us to start crossing those bridges to create better connections, whether back in the day it was with somebody I interviewed, whether it's with your students, whether it's with our family, whether it's within our own businesses, our customers. It doesn't take any extra effort. It just takes, as you said, the moment to slow down, to realize the outcome is the most important thing. Doing the right thing is more important than being right. And just having the, maybe we'll get to this next, having the genuine humility to truly appreciate where somebody else is coming from. So does that tie into your definition, perception of humility?
I tell you, Michael, it does perfectly, right? Because I'm self-reflective, I'm self-aware, I start to develop a balanced perspective, and in the balanced perspective, I understand multiple perspectives, which gives me the ability to start to develop true self-confidence. Mike, I don't know the answer to that. You tell me how fast you need an answer. I'll get you an answer. I know somebody who knows, right? And then the fourth and last one is all about genuine humility. And of course, I never say self-reflection, self-confidence without true. So I don't say humility without genuine, which raises the question, how do you know if you have genuine humility? And when I was writing that about that, your listeners will love this, I think. I asked a question, several hundred people, Mike, and I said, how did you get to where you are in your life so far? All of your listeners, based on their education, based on their work to date, based on their career, how did you get to where you are so far? It's a fantastic question. Having asked this of hundreds of people, Michael, it's sort of interesting. It could be at any level, any country, whatever. The top two responses I hear, Michael, are, how did I get to here? I worked very hard and I have several skill sets. And the combination of working hard and skill sets, that's how I got to where I am. Now, if you, Michael, say, well, Harry, how did you get to where you are as the CEO of a company and a professor at Kellogg? If I don't think about it and not self-reflective, I'd say, Mike, I work pretty hard. I have several skill sets. But you and I, Mike, like see it in your face. You and I are becoming more self-reflective. So if I'm a little more self-reflective, how did I get to where I am? I'll give you five things, Mike, that impacted my career. And your listeners, maybe one, two, couple of these may apply to them. I don't know. But here's five for you. No order, but math majors, we number things. Number one, luck. I was a pretty lucky guy, okay? Now, can you plan for luck? I don't know. I was pretty lucky, number one. Number two, timing. Being in the right place at the right time. Now, some of my friends, Mike, they combine luck and timing. I don't know if this happened to you, but here's how open I am, Mike. There were several times in my career when I got promoted, the person who was in the job before me, when they were in the job, they accomplished nothing. You replace those people, you look like you walk on water. In fact, Mike, one time I literally said, hey, I'm just breathing. Big improvement over the last guy who was in this job, okay? Number three is the team. We could spend a lot of time talking about this, Mike, but the Cliff Note version is, as you well know, once you're a leader, it's no longer about you. If I've got 8 out of 8 people, no matter what level, and they're the right people, and I'm developing them, I care about them, they'll do anything for you, right? It's the right thing to do, and then you get the benefit, right? Some students will say, oh, you were the CFO when you were in your 30s, you were the CEO when you were 40. You must have been this bright guy. Mike, this is not a humility comment. I had three things going for me. One, I took the time to get to know everybody. Two, by getting to know everybody, I find out who the really good people are. And every job I was ever in, Mike, I tried to create an environment, my friend, that everybody wanted to work for me. Now, let's keep this simple. If you know who the really good people are and they want to work for you, you're going to do really well. Luck, timing, the team. The fourth one, mentors and sponsors. Mike, I don't know about you, but I had several people. Dean Jacobs was one of them. Mr. Graham was another. I could probably name 10, 12 people. If it wasn't for them, there is no scenario I would have been in these jobs. Mike, as you know, you never forget the people who help. And maybe you feel a moral responsibility to pay it forward. Who are the people behind us that we're trying to help, right? Luck, timing, the team, mentors. The fifth one, I always put this fifth because I want to always make sure people are sensitive, you know, church, state. For me, the fifth one, faith, spiritual perspectives. Quite frankly, all the talents I've received, my view is it's from the man upstairs, okay? You never, never forget where you came from. And, you know, when people compliment me, I realize, hey, these are talents I've received. I'm supposed to use to the best of my ability. Now, if any of those five work for you, could be luck, timing, team, mentors, maybe your perspective of the man upstairs. I start to realize people start to think a value-based leader, Mike, you never forget where you came from because many of us start off with very little or nothing. You keep things in perspective. And as we mentioned before, Mike, this is a big one. You know a lot of people. You give a lot of talks. The higher you go up in an organization, there are going to be people that are going to start to say, Harry, you're amazing. Harry, you're remarkable. If Harry starts to believe it, he's got a real, real problem. Why? The little model that you mentioned up front, leadership, influence, relate. Most people do not relate well to egomaniacs. Most people don't relate well to people where it's all about them. And when you start to realize every single person matters, every single person matters. And the reason I say, Mike, genuine humility, you and I have worked with a lot of people who can act humble, who you know it's all a lot of talk. Thinking this, you look like a total idiot, right? Because there are no secrets. You know that well. So you better believe it or don't even waste any time. Don't even waste any time. And the way, Mike, for your listeners too, the way I sort of capitalized this thing, I had a group of 100 students the other night, and I literally said, how many of you really want to be value-based leaders? Everybody raise their hand. How many of you people think you relate well to people? Everybody raise their hand. I said, don't raise your hand this time because I don't want to embarrass you. But how many of you, when you walk into the building, say hello to the receptionist, ask her how her children are doing and what their day's like? How many of you, when you go into the cafeteria, thank every single person that's making all this great food for you and ask them what their favorite sport team is, right? And then when you come in the office and you're in the office and it's late at night because we're working on a project, you're getting ready for a podcast, whatever you're doing, and the cleaning crew comes in and they're emptying out the trash baskets, right? You know, mine's right here. How many of you take 5 minutes, empty out a trash basket, thank them for what they're doing and ask them, you know, what sports teams they like? And by the way, I always tell people, doing this thing with the trash has nothing to do with being a nice guy. It's actually, Michael, in my case, believe it or not, a little selfish, because when I'm doing that, this happened the other night, it gave me a time to reflect and realize, what do I know for a fact, Mike? If it wasn't for luck, timing, the team, mentors, and I could easily be part of the cleaning crew. I'm under no illusion. You never forget. You and I are so blessed. You never forget where you came from and why. So that's the four. By the way, Mike, you're such good at this. I just gave you my whole 30-hour class. You get a star now. It's the whole class, the four principles.
Well, if you could have Kellogg send me the diploma, then that'd really be.
Well, what I will do, Michael, is at a minimum, buddy, I will actually send you the first book, okay, from Values to Action, the four principles. You send me your address, buddy. I'll send you the book.
I'd be grateful. So a couple of things I want to go back to. I love the five, for lack of a better word, factors that you give credit to driving. I'm going to add two. I agree with all of that. And they kind of fall under, I'm going to put family. I know they're under mentors, but I'm going to add that too.
Absolutely.
There also had to have been an army of guardian angels watching over me to get me from where I was to where I am today. But those half joke, well, the family part isn't a half joke, but the half joke aside, you said something several times that really resonates with me. Don't ever forget where you were. Like, don't forget your roots. Don't forget where you come from. I'm asking for a friend here with this question. But when it comes to that balance of humility and confidence, how have you learned, or how would you potentially advise someone, or as you like to say, share your opinion with someone, where we came from and where we are can be such drastically different places, and how we've evolved as people over time can be so great that, well, yes, it is so important to remember our roots and where we came from, but sometimes it's difficult for our mental picture to evolve as well. Like, we still see ourselves, maybe I'm asking for a friend, maybe I'm asking for myself. We still see ourselves as the person that we were at a certain juncture in our life, but other people see us for who we've grown to become. So how have you learned to balance and to teach others to remember your roots and stay humble, but also appreciate who you are and the impact you can have on others at your current stage in life?
Yeah, well, wow. I mean, that's like, this is life itself. So to me, it's a combination of a couple things. One, you don't forget where you came from. You spend some time with people that either you grew up with or your spouse or your parents or whatever, so that you remember parts of that. But at the same time, now you've actually grown. You've actually developed, hopefully, into a bit. So now, reflecting on that, having people that you're now with, people that have maybe seen you grow, who've taken pleasure in and them mentoring you to help you become who you are, and this nice balance between, here's another way of thinking about it. When I talk about true self-confidence and genuine humility, it's sort of interesting, Mike. Some students will say, even executives will say, you know, maybe I need more true self, a little less humility, or maybe more humility, less. And my view is you want more of both. You want more of both. In fact, the way I would articulate it, Mike, beyond words, if you're my boss, it doesn't matter what level we are. If you're my boss, I want you to know whatever you need to get done, I'll get it done. I will get it done. You can count on me. Why? Not because I'm that great. It's because of these people. It's because of this team, okay? And so this whole idea of I'm really good, but I'm going to get a lot better. And everything I do, it's because of this team that helped me do it. And some people will say, well, maybe I need to have less humility. Well, you know what? When you realize every single person matters, and at the same time, you're really good and you're going to get a lot better. And so what did you learn from the past? But to your point, where am I now? And do I really understand that distinction? Because now I may be responsible for a lot more things than I ever was when I was starting out. So it's that healthy balance. We always go back to balance, Michael.
I love that. And it's not always easy.
No.
I definitely appreciate that. And when we think about achieving that balance and looking both ways, I was thinking as you were talking about people who fake humility versus those that actually have it. For me personally, I feel like my self-confidence can ebb and flow depending on the situation, the day, the place, whatever. And that's probably true for most of us. And I imagine that's part of being human.
Yeah.
But for me, especially in the scenario where I'm talking with somebody, regardless of the context, I feel like my self-confidence is at a pretty good level if I balance with humility. If I don't feel the need to either argue or one up. Like, I went to this really cool place. Oh, wait till you hear the cool place I went to. I've got this great idea. Have I told you my good idea? I think this will really work. It probably will, but this might too. I feel like for me, when I feel myself really wanting to get those pieces in, that's when I've got to check my humility and self-confidence and say, my ego's playing here. I wonder why. And often as an observer, when I see others doing that, that typically is a tip off for me that, okay, now I have to figure out how to help this person manage their ego in order to get to where I need to go. How does that line up with your experience?
Lines up perfectly, Chief. Lines up perfectly. You know, constantly asking yourself, you know, do I have this remarkable need to be right? Do I have this remarkable need to be the smartest person in the room? No. I come in, I'm part of a team. I will give my views, but I'm not stuck on that because it isn't about me. It really is, you know, and by the way, here's another great way to think about it. And this may be true for a lot of your viewers as well. It's sort of interesting, Mike. A lot of people in a job, well, let's play it out this way. You're the boss and you're maybe a vice president. I'm a director and I work for you. There's a lot of people that would be in my role that I want you to know I'm completely irreplaceable. I mean, I'm just irreplaceable. And a little story, you asked me to do something and I got six people working for me and you say, here, I need an update on that. And I get the collection of the work they've done and I come up by myself and I just really impress you and I'm just irreplaceable. Well, early on, I decided, wait a minute, when my boss, you, asked me something and I got six people working on it, I'm going to bring all six people up to see you with me. I'm going to introduce the topic and I'm going to have each of them do it. And several times in my career, the reality is 3 days later, Michael, there was an open position. And in the first case, well, it couldn't be Harry because Harry's irreplaceable. In the second situation, you say, wait a minute, I could put Harry in that position because there's at least three of his people to replace. So the crazy part of it is the faster you make yourself replaceable, by the better off you're going to do. And when you make yourself irreplaceable, okay, people are wondering why they don't get promoted. Now, because remember, Michael, we always have to have a sense of humor, okay? I always remind people the balance thing, okay? You better be relatively good or you will get replaced and you will not have a job, right? So there is a little bit of balance that goes on here, a little bit of balance. But overall, why wouldn't you develop your team so that to their full potential and help you get your job done so I can help you do your job?
Gets back to your common sense that isn't so common anymore. And not only are in that scenario, are you making yourself replaceable so you can move up, even if you're not moved up, now your team knows that their contributions matter. They have a voice. They're getting recognition for what their actual contributions are. I can only imagine with all of the consulting work you do on top of your professor work, how many times you've walked into an organization and talked to a team that says, my boss takes all the credit.
All the time. Michael, it's just absolutely crazy. And then that person wonders why they don't have the best people working for them. I mean, again, Michael, it sounds like a humility thing, but no exaggeration. I always had the best people working for me. Not that I was a nice guy, but it was like, hey, this guy is going to help develop me. This guy's going to tell me when I do a good job. This guy's going to make sure I got visibility. I mean, my God, if this is so ridiculously simple, but you have to park your ego at the door because it's not about you. It's about the team.
Yeah. And parking our ego at the door requires us all to admit that we do have an ego. So that way we can park it at the door. In that last explanation, you talked about essentially giving feedback, letting people know where they're being successful and giving them the visibility, all of those things. Yeah. I believe I saw a line that you wrote that said providing feedback is a moral requirement. Did I get that right?
Michael, you are absolutely, I know to say this, you're phenomenal. You're absolutely phenomenal because let's talk about this a minute. You're a leader. You got a team, okay? And anybody on this call who's leading a team, once you're a leader, your most important responsibility is help those people develop to their full potential, okay? Now, how do you do that? To your point. Well, that you got to provide feedback. Now, Michael, you visit a lot of companies. You've been in a lot of organizations. And what happens, let's be honest, many organizations struggle with this feedback, right? They really struggle with it. I was visiting one company not too long ago, Michael. I know you got a sense of humor. And I said, well, do you guys focus on feedback? Oh, we do that. We do that. We have that form. It's in human resources. And once a year, I sit down with Michael. He's sweating. We go through this mating dance. It's over till next year. That has nothing to do. When I say the word feedback, Michael, it stands for open, honest, continuous, transparent feedback. It basically means, Mike, if you work for me, you will have my honest perception of what you do well, what are some things to work on, what I can do to help you, what outside advice can we bring in. I will treat you exactly the way I would like to be treated. And when people say, well, how do you know if you're good at feedback? Very simple. If I'm good at feedback, Mike, I will never surprise you. I will never surprise you. And by the way, do I understand that most organizations, they have this form once a year? Fine, I got it. But guess what? Right after you have that form, if this the next day, you and I are at a customer, the next day, before we get back in the car after seeing the customer, Michael, before we turn the ignition on the car, Michael, what went well? What didn't go well? It's a continuous process. And the reason why I call it a moral responsibility, think of people that we've worked for. I say, hey, Michael, can you give me some feedback? Here, I'll give you some feedback. Just keep doing what you're doing. Hard to improve if you just keep doing what you're doing. Okay? No, this is a honest, ongoing development. And here's why I say more responsibility. This happens all the time, Michael. You come to the company, you come to Baxter, you're 21 years old, and you're a great guy. I'm just making this up. You're a great guy, but there's something that's not good. Maybe you're not a really good at communicator, okay? Well, but I like you. You're doing a good job. I don't want to ruin the relationship. So we never really deal with this. This goes on for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, I get replaced. And Joe's now the boss. The first week, Joe sits down and says, hey, you know what, Mike, you're a great guy, but the fact you've been here for 5 years and you've got this community, that's going to hold you back. All right, stop the clock. We wasted 5 years of your life. Why? because I'm trying to be nice. Well, guess what? If you had known 5 years ago, you may have said, I just got out of school. I better shove this into fifth gear. Or maybe communications is so big, maybe I shouldn't be in sales. Maybe I should be doing something else, right? This moral responsibility to treat you the way I like to be treated. And here's the other bonus round, Mike. In 20-some years at Baxter, I had to have quite a few people leave Baxter. And you know what? Very rarely did I fire somebody. Very rarely. Because on an ongoing basis, you're saying to me, hey, Harry, based on expectations, this isn't really working, is it? You know, Mike, it really isn't. And you're a great guy, but you shouldn't be in a $13 billion company with 55,000 people. You'd be great in a small company. And you know why? Because I'm going to treat you exactly the way I'd like to be treated. I'll help you find a job. I will treat you exactly the way I'd like to be treated. Golden rule, you name it. But so many people, Michael, they struggle. And somebody asked me the other day, why is it? Here's a little quick formula for you. Most human beings, tell me what you think of this. Most human beings would like to be liked. So here's the problem. If I focus on being liked, the chance of being respected, I actually think is relatively low. Okay. But here's the good news. If I sit down with you and say, hey, Michael, I care about you. This is a problem. This is an issue. I think I could actually be respected. And guess what? By being respected, I could actually be liked. So I don't walk away from being liked, but if you think about it in mathematical terms as an old math major, being liked is the dependent, that's the conclusion. If I start off being liked, I'm never going to help you develop. So this is such a big issue, Michael. That's why I spend a lot of time thinking and writing about it, for sure.
I love the way you put it at the end. We don't start off being liked. We earn being liked. The process that we employ ends up with being liked. We don't start that way. And it might create a little bit of discomfort. It might be a rocky road, kind of the illustration you made earlier. It's a bit of a roller coaster. It's not a linear progression, but it gets us where we need to be at the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. Well said.
We've talked a lot today with your CEO experience and a lot with your consulting experience. We mentioned a little bit your work as a professor as well. I think maybe too much emphasis gets placed on generational differences. At heart, we're all human beings. We were born at different times. So there's kind of little things on the surface that are different, but maybe I might be a man on an island with this perspective. But I think even across generations, we have more in common than we don't. So I'm curious, as you work with younger generations that are coming up through school, how do you, let me ask it this way. Do you see yourself having to adapt your processes at all to connect with younger up and coming generations? Or do they, by and large, do they still apply equally as compared to the generations you worked with when you were leading the workforce?
Yeah. So that, Michael, this one's an interesting one. And in this one, I'll always tell you where I agree or disagree. But this one, I think we're going to be in like total agreement on. And here's the thought. And this is another one of these. Everything is a balance. Everything is a balance. And let's extend what you said. Clearly, we've all heard about baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z. And people will talk about certain characteristics that mean. Now, I have no problem thinking about, and are there some trends, whatever. However, Michael, as you mentioned, every single person is unique. And when I say that formula 10 times a day, leadership, influence, relate, you've got to, as you know, and I think you seem to do this pretty well, you got to be able to relate uniquely to each person because each person is different. All right, let's get real specific. I've got 5 brothers and sisters, Michael. We're all baby boomers. Guess what? We're all unbelievably different, okay? I'm sort of driven. As one of my brothers is just kind of more crazy. And now I've got 5 children. I got one daughter who went to Kellogg. She is literally like a, you know, let's make it happen. And then I've got, you know, daughter Shannon the Cannon, who's, you know, kind of loose, and she's in Australia one time. So everybody's different. So I kind of look at it as, can you get to know each person and understand how do I relate to this Michael guy? Okay. Is he motivated by money? Is he motivated to be part of the team? Is he motivated by recognition? Every single person's different and everybody learns different. Right? Some people are visual. Some people have to read. So I kind of look at it as I want all of my students to realize, hey, I respect you as an individual. You tell me what works out well. Hey, does some of you want to give me a call? Fine. Some of you want to meet in my office? Okay. Let's figure out what works best for you. And as I get them a little bit being self-reflective, I realize there's an awful lot that unites us as human beings, okay? And I think we seem sometimes, Michael, to focus more on, you know, the 5% of the differences than the 95% that actually brings us together.
For sure. And anytime I'm asked, I shouldn't say anytime, because there's I'd stay away from this statement from time to time. But I tend to remind people that, remember, the people who create these generational differences profit from creating that. So, like, yeah, some people are going to be more digitally motivated. Some people are going to be more that they'd rather shake your hand, send an email. I get all of that. It changes over time. There's an arc and evolution to all of us. But don't forget, the people that tell you that the baby boomer is way different from Gen Z got paid a lot of money to create that cute little infographic to tell you all about it. And they can't continue to get paid if they don't get you to believe it. The universality of the human experience is so vast that if we just took the time to focus on that, we'd all be so much more productive.
Yeah. Well, and again, Mike, that's when I say we can talk about anything, and I would say their opinions, you remind me of another one that folks talk about, because this feedback thing, my friend, really goes both ways, right? Because if I'm the leader, I want to get feedback, but I need to receive feedback. And people say, well, geez, Harry, how do you do that as a leader? Well, I sit down with you and say, hey, Michael, this is a gift. It is a moral responsibility. But I'd love to get some input from you. And a lot of people will say, it's one that drives me crazy. I know this one, this generational thing may get you going, but the one that gets me is people say, oh no, we have this 360 thing, and we have this 360, and we can get all this information or whatever. And I stealing your comment, Michael, I said, I got a lot of friends of mine that are in consulting. Isn't it amazing? They've created a multi-billion-dollar business because we can't communicate with one another, okay? I mean, you got to give these guys credit. It's absolutely amazing what these people have done, okay? Now, you know, shame on you if you can't create a culture where you're scared to say, well, geez, I don't know if I should tell Harry what he thinks because I could get fired. Well, if I haven't demonstrated enough true relationship with you that you trust me, well, then maybe I shouldn't even be in the job. There we go.
And I'm with you on that one, too. I was recently speaking at an event, and one of the other speakers was talking about employee retention and different things to do and different programs and stuff. And it was all in line. It was a great talk. Nothing about the person I was giving the talk. And somebody asked me a question about it when I was speaking. And I said, hey, listen, this might be an unpopular opinion. You save yourself a lot of time and money. Just say hello to everybody you walk past.
Exactly.
All that money that you just set aside for employee retention programs, have the barbecue, take them to the amusement park. I mean, do the nice things. That's fine. But if you just said hello to every single person you ever walk past, they wouldn't think you're a jerk. They'd probably stay longer.
Exactly. No, I'm only smiling because everybody kind of teases me. I walk into the building. I know the name of every receptionist. I know the name of every. I mean, it just seems like the logical thing to do. Michael, just saying hello to people, it makes their whole day. I mean, it's amazing. And the crazy part of it is, it's like the ultimate win-win, right? Because not only is it the right thing to do, but if I'm here late at night, part of the cleaning guy, he'll bring me a Diet Coke. Hey, Harry, I want to get to... Wait, why? Hey, we're kind of friends. We're friends. Why not? It's not that hard, Michael. It really is not that hard.
No, it's not hard at all. And one quick thought on the feedback or asking for feedback. I'm going to geek out for half a second here. I'll keep it short. But one of the techniques that we really believe in is that illustrate before you investigate, like help somebody understand where you're coming from before you ask. So if I am the boss, so to speak, if I'm in the superior position, I'm asking for feedback. If I just say, so Harry, what feedback do you have for me? There's no incentive for you to be honest there. None. But if I say, hey, Harry, over the years, I had this problem that I wouldn't have corrected if somebody didn't bring to my attention. I thought I was doing this right until somebody told me I was doing it wrong. And unfortunately, from where I sit, there's no way for me to know how the rest of the world is experiencing this because I kind of have doors and walls and people don't always communicate with me. So I'd be grateful if you could please tell me what are the three things I can improve on the most. So by showing that self-effacing humility first with specific examples, asking for a number. I don't care what the number is, 2, 3, 5, whatever. And if I only get one, that's one more than I would have got anyway. So asking for a specific number, but then most importantly, after that, finding another time, a day, a week, a month later to say, Harry, thank you for telling me. Here's the adjustment I made. If you still see me screwing it up, let me know. If you can do that with everybody on your team within 2, 3, 4 months, you know better than me. the type of culture shift that you'll see with that feedback loop going.
Yeah. Well, Michael, not only is that great, I'll even give you a little addition to it, which is helpful. If I come to you and say, you're my boss, hey, Michael, hey, I'd really love feedback. Of course, some guys will say, just keep doing what you're doing or, you know, whatever, whatever. And so with one guy, and I've done this several times, it's worked out pretty well. I finally came back to you and said, hey, Michael, you know what? I've thought a lot about this and I've decided here's three things I really need to work on. And I'd love to get your feedback. I think I really need to work on these three things. I've had now three bosses of different said, well, no, those are okay. But now that you bring it up, I got two for you, pal, that you really should work on. Okay. Sometimes you just got to get them open, right? You got to get them open for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. I could continue this conversation all day, but I know you have a lot of other things on your plate, including promoting your newest book. So to start to bring this full circle, please let us know about your new book, where people can find it, what to look for in it. And then beyond that, for everyone that's listened to this and they say, I need more of Harry, where can they find you to connect with you and continue learning from you?
Well, really, really enjoyed the time with you, Michael. So a couple things. One, I have several students here at Northwestern University, the Kellogg School of Management. They actually set up a website for me. And anybody can go there, Michael. It's just, as you well know, it's just harrykramer.org. And there's information on the four principles, all the reflection questions. They can see all four of the books. There's actually even some videos there. If I get a copy of your thing, I'll put that there too, Michael. That's very, very helpful. The new book, which is your value-based legacy, that becomes available beginning tomorrow. Actually, I should say November 5th, because I'll see this a couple weeks from now. November the 5th, they can get it on Amazon. I should mention one thing, Michael. The proceeds from the book, and I go around to a lot of organizations and I give talks, similar to the one that you saw me do in New York. Rather than having a speaker fee, I basically say to folks, hey, just make a contribution to the 1 Acre Fund in Africa. I'll just mention real quickly, Michael, people can just look up oneacrefund.org. And this was a student. We talk about those guys, Michael. I had a student who basically said, took a trip to Kenya and said, I'm one of those guys. I said, what does that mean? Well, I'm turning down jobs in the States. I'm moving to Africa because, Harry, I spent 2 weeks over there. I can't get over the fact there's more than 800 million people that aren't eating and they turn out to be farmers. How does a farmer start? That doesn't even make a lot of sense. And it turned out when Kenya got its independence back in the 60s, if you were a citizen, you could got a 1 acre plot, but you weren't generating enough income to keep your kids alive. So guess what? This fellow, you can look up 1 Acre Fund. His name is Andrew Youn, Youn. You can look at the TED Talk. Here are the facts, Michael, which I think will blow your mind. He's been over there now, I think for 18 years. He started in Kenya. He's in Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania. I think they're starting in Ethiopia. They have doubled or tripled the annual crop yield on 4 million farms that has saved the lives of 12 million kids. And he's not coming back. So when the first book came out, Mike, I read this several times, From Values to Action, on the cover. And I thought, you know what? He's the best example of From Values to Action. So I said, here's the deal. When I'm not teaching and I'm not running around on boards, I originally said once a month, Michael, I will do talks, companies, associations, colleges, and all the proceeds would go to the 1 Acre Fund, and all the sale of the books will all go to the 1 Acre Fund. So I thought I'd do one a month, Michael, but having a high energy level like you, I decided I could probably do a little more. So basically, I've averaged at least two a week for the last now 15 years. I gave a talk to a big company in Chicago last week, Michael. It was my 1,553rd talk for this 1 Acre Fund. And I told the folks, now that I got the fourth book, I'm just going to keep talking. And again, all the proceeds go to the 1 Acre Fund. So harrykramer.org, it's all there. You can look it on Amazon. And really, really enjoy taking the time with you today, Michael.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I've loved every minute of this. I will also have the links for the 1 Acre Fund on. I'm sure there's a link there where people can donate. So I'll put that there as well if people would like to donate. So we'll keep that moving forward. Thank you so much. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for all that you serve. Thank you for taking the time today to be so open with everything that you shared with us. I'm truly grateful for it. And I look forward to creating another time to continue these conversations.
Well, Michael, I appreciate it. I appreciate listening to your talk. I took a lot of notes when you and I were in New York together, and I think the two of us was great. So maybe sometime we'll have a chance to do something together again. I hope we do. And you got my mobile number, I believe. So you should feel free to call me anytime, Michael, anytime. And I wish you and your audience the very, very best.
Oh, that's a promise. And you might regret telling me that publicly, because now I know I've got permission. I'm going to start calling. But I would love to take you up on the offer to share the stage again and continue to work together. So thank you again. This has truly been my pleasure. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Absolutely, buddy. Take care.
Harry, thank you for an awesome conversation. You went into so much more depth than you did the first time I saw you. I truly appreciate you taking the time and everything that you shared with us today. Thank you so much. I was taking notes the whole time. I hope everybody listening along was taking notes and learning along with me. That was a great conversation. Thank you so much. You touched on so many things that are worth recapping, but I really think it has to start with the importance of knowing, understanding, and being open about what we don't know, and then surrounding ourselves with people who know what we don't, so we can be successful together. And I love your thought that they already know what we don't know, so there's no sense in trying to hide it. We may as well be open about it and work through it together, which leads back to your foundation principle of self-reflection. If we all take the time to honestly self-reflect, what we can achieve, what we can build, how we can grow and evolve from there is substantial. I really appreciate that. And of course, I loved your line of be those guys. Instead of waiting for those guys, be those guys and go create the results in the teams that we're looking for. Harry, that was amazing. Thank you so very much. And thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to another great episode. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate you supporting us and learning from the people who are so gracious to share their time and their expertise. Before we go, let's thank our sponsors one more time. If you haven't already, please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can take the training to develop the skills to recognize what people are likely thinking and feeling in real time, by recognizing emotional shifts through changes in facial expressions and nonverbal communication. Read their research, choose the training that's right for you, and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, once again, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn everything you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers. Membership requirements, online education, in-person education, interviewer resources, networking opportunities, and so much more. That's also where you'll learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What are the qualifications, the prerequisites? What does it take to earn the designation, maintain the designation? What could it mean for you and your career moving forward? All that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, we'd appreciate it if you went over to inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, their negotiators, and their HR teams to teach them how to obtain the everyday confessions that help them unlock the truth and achieve their goals in their high-value conversations. All of that and more at inquasive.com. Thank you all again, week after week, for being here. We truly appreciate it. Please like the show, share the show, leave us your feedback, subscribe, tell your friends about it. We appreciate all your time and support. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.